I'll just briefly, if I can, incapable of brevity, as you all know, I'll try to recapitulate. So I was talking about my own principal inspiration in life and what I consider to be the inspiration behind this particular centre, this particular order, this particular community, the Tri Ratna Bauda Mahasangha, the Tri Ratna Buddhist community. And I started by talking about that in terms of the Buddha, what happened to the Buddha at Bodh Gaya, and his realization of enlightenment, Bodhi, awakening. And I described what happened to him as his discovery, his awakening to a new kind of consciousness from the Buddhist point of view, the first time that it had been experienced in history. We can't say, but from our point of view, it's considered in that way. And it's a consciousness that's radically different from our own because it is not self-centered. That consciousness does not reflect back to I. It does not base itself upon me and my interests, which already makes it completely incomprehensible to us because habitually, ancestrally, we see things in that way, just because of perhaps thousands of years of evolution, if you want to take that line, if you want to take a more traditional Buddhist point of view, because of clinging over countless rebirths. But we are habituated to see the world in terms of me and not me, and to assess it in terms of my interests. What happens to the Buddha at Bodh Gaya is that he just breaks through that. How and why is another story, but he breaks through it, and he experiences thereby complete clarity of mind, because what makes us unclear, what makes us confused, what makes us wrong is that self-clinging. Because we look at the world through the spectacles of I, we distort it. I being always conditioned by particular experience, other conditioning factors, social, biological, whatever. They all determine how the world appears to us, which is virtually how it is, if you like. But the Buddha doesn't do that. So what appears to him is what is. And he knows that it's constructed by the senses and so forth. It's not taken in by the appearance of things. It's a long story there, isn't there? But you get the general picture. That freedom from self-clinging also changes, of course, his relationship to other beings, in fact, to all of reality, because there's no longer a sense of a gap, me, not me, me, other. It's gone. It doesn't see things in that way. Just one field of consciousness, of course, richly experiencing his own sensations, just as we did in the meditation, but not privileging those over other aspects of consciousness. This is not merely a kind of a cognitive shift. It marks a shift in feeling, you could say, although it's feeling only as an analogy. There's a sense, you could say, of oneness, of unity, to put it that way, vastly overused metaphors, a sense of love, but a love that is impartial, that is completely spontaneous, and that is not owned, as it were, that is suprapersonal, that goes beyond the individual. Just a strong sense of connection with, understanding of all other beings or life. And I illustrated that by the Buddha's, one of his abhinyas, one of his supernatural powers. No, it's not that. Super knowledges. That's the term that's usually translated as. That was his ability to see where beings had come from in previous lives and where they were bound, as it were, from this life. What I take that to mean is that because there was no partiality, he could see really what's going on. It was just obvious to him. He looked at somebody, could see what state they were in, you see where that state came from and what its trajectory was. It's put in terms of multiple lives, but we don't even have to think like that. You can just, if you're in a particularly open and metaful, maitriful, loving mood, you can just see people and you delight in them, and you also see what's happening with them. So for the Buddha, this is his abiding state of awareness of others. He's always able to see people in that way, with no sense of judgment in the sense of bad, wrong, nasty, I don't like. None of that. No likes, dislikes. A sense of compassion, in other words, of compassion for the suffering that beings again and again bring upon themselves through their ignorance. So this kind of consciousness, this new kind of consciousness that, according to Buddhist tradition, entered the world at that moment under the tree at Bodh Gaya 2,500 and tum-ti-tum years ago, has animated the whole Buddhist tradition to this day. Not, as I said yesterday, not merely as a set of teachings that are spoken from that position, although those are there because they give us a way of relating to it. The Buddha speaks to us from that state, and we, taking his expression of that state, can get nearer to that state for ourselves, if you see what I mean. So, yes, it is in the words, but it's more than the words. The words are intended to communicate this state of freedom from self-attachment, which brings, as I mentioned yesterday, a tremendous sense of bliss, of freedom. And I mentioned that the Buddha at Bodh Gaya, wasn't Bodh Gaya then, it was just Uruvela, the sandy bank. He just moved around that area, sitting under tree after tree, and the texts describe him as experiencing the bliss of release, the bliss of release. He's free. None of that, the torment of I. You know what I mean. Sometimes the I is such a drag. I remember, very poignant actually, that my mother, in the last years of her life, she had a stroke, and she was an extremely vigorous New Zealander and was confined to her bed. You know what New Zealand women are like. The Maitri Vajra is not here for me to get at her. But anyway, you're lying on her bed, unable to do anything except for order us about. And we were extremely unobliging. Nothing to do. She couldn't really do anything. She was fully alert and so forth. But I remember once when I went to see her, after the obligatory ticking off for not having seen her more recently and so forth, she just said, "I'm sick of being me." I knew exactly what she meant. Just sick of being me. This constant coming back to I, and this constant reconstruction of the world on the basis of your own clinging to identity. So the Buddha's free from that, experiences the bliss of release from that tyranny of I, which of course for us, when we hear that, the idea of being free from I sounds like a terrible sort of nothing, a terrible negative, a terrible loss. But according to the Buddha, it's a tremendous freedom, a blissful freedom. So it's that state of mind that the Buddha experienced that the whole Buddhist tradition emerges out of and tries to emerge back into. And that is not merely a set of postulates or a story, but is something felt and even experienced. And I mentioned myself first encountering the Buddha, really, in reading a collection of Buddhist scriptures and having a strong sense of the Buddha as a presence. I'm not stupid enough to think that, you know, that in some way he was a spirit coming to me. I can't in a way say what it was, but I definitely felt that I knew the Buddha, at least as far as I could. I was in contact with the Buddha as a real human communication, in a sense. I could sense what his presence was like. And it's that that's animated the whole tradition. That's why we have a figure of the Buddha here, so that we can not merely sort of remember the Buddha, oh, the Buddha 2,500 years ago, but that we can, through the figure, connect with what that figure represents in terms of a new kind of consciousness, which then becomes something alive amongst us. You know, even while I begin to speak about it here, just a little bit, it comes into our consciousness, and it becomes something that we share to a limited extent, maybe, or to a greater or lesser extent. But when we begin to focus on that consciousness, it becomes something that we know. We know deep inside ourselves that this is the real thing. This is what it's about. This is what is really important. And as Buddhists, we try to base ourselves upon that consciousness, not merely on the words that that consciousness expressed or the practices that that consciousness taught us so that we can get to it, but on the consciousness itself, the living consciousness itself, the living awareness. And I made it clear yesterday, when I talk about consciousness, I don't want us to think of sort of static searchlight that's just illuminating the world. Consciousness, from a Buddhist point of view, citta would be the best word. Sometimes it's even translated as heart, because the heart in Buddhism is the seat of awareness. We locate awareness up here, but at least in the broad Western tradition. But for Buddhism, consciousness is seated here. So, for instance, when we do in the salutation, go Om Ah Hung, Om is that's body. The body is located here. The body's center is located here. Speech is communication is centered here, and mind is centered here. So you're going body, speech, and mind. It's, in other words, with the whole of me, I salute to the Buddha. So when we talk about citta, which is the best word of all the Buddhist words in this context, what we're connoting is not merely awareness, but dynamic awareness, rich awareness, colourful awareness, awareness that has a rich feeling tone to it, if you see what I mean. It's as much to do with feeling in a broad way, with emotion, more like aesthetic sensation, aesthetic awareness. Sometimes it's been described as that. A kind of appreciative, aesthetic awareness, an awareness of the world which is sensitive. So that consciousness, that citta, that bodhicitta, bodhi being the word for the Buddha's awakening, from which the word Buddha is derived or is connected etymologically. Bodhi means awakening. It means enlightenment in our general usage, the coming of light, the light that chases away the darkness. Bodhicitta means a citta, an awareness that is flooded with light, that is fully awake, and that is, as it were, dynamic, is moving, is transformative, affects the world. So as Buddhists, we feel ourselves to be affected by that mind. And I remember that very, very clearly, my own first encounter with the Buddha. as I say, in reading Edward Conze's Buddhist Scriptures, a Penguin book. Not a particularly lively account, but a pretty good account. I remember how he's a different man. I'd sort of connected with something more than myself that I felt to be real and true, and that sort of began to live in me a little bit. Of course, it was me that was stopping it living more. It was my own self-attachment stopping it living more. But it affected me such that I've shaped my own life. I might shape my life from then on upon that. And that's what Buddhists do. They may not think of it quite in these terms. I'm unfolding it in a particular way. They connect with that consciousness, which they even worship, in the sense of they bow down to it, because they consider it to be the thing. It's what it's about. It's what is most valuable. And that's the sense in which we worship, not that we try to get answers to our questions. And if I was in India, I'd say, get pass your exams or get a child. That's what religion is supposed to do. It's not to do with your worldly life. You worship it because it's for you the supreme value, which you want to live within yourself. And then as Buddhists, we engage in activity, which we try to base upon that awareness, that consciousness, that bodhicitta. We try to engage in activity that we think will realize that through doing that we will attain it, we will attain, it's not something we attain, that we will get out of the way of, and that will live through us. And we try to act on its basis, act within the world on the basis of that wisdom, that great clarity which comes from lack of self-clinging, and that love, or maitri is the Buddhist word, which isn't quite love in the general sense, although perhaps it is of, in its kind of best usages in the West. Love is a good term when it's taken in that way. But we try to live on that basis. So that's what founded this place. Unfortunately, it founded it through imperfect tools, us lot. I had a hand in getting this all together, and I assure you it was a very imperfect hand. But still it was animated by that spirit, and everything that you see here has come about from that, and everything that's wrong with it is our fault, and everything that's good about it comes from that bodhicitta. We have to get out of the way, and that takes a lot of work, because this sense of self-clinging, the sense of I, is so deeply embedded, we don't even know how deep it is. We'll come to that in a moment, because we're going to try to tackle the beast. Although I did stress yesterday, it's not a beast, it's just normal. I've got one. I own up. And I own up without fear, because I know you have too. Well, I pretty well assume you have. If you haven't, you don't mind my saying so. But it's pretty general, I assure you. Throw a stone and you'll hit one. We have to try to get ourselves out of the way so that new kind of consciousness that came into the world 2,500 years ago can operate more and more fully. And my goodness, does the world need it. I finished yesterday rather briefly, but I think quite importantly, by saying that one of the most powerful ways in which we try to generate that amongst us as Buddhists, and particularly within our own Triratna tradition, is by our forming community. I mean community in every sense, community at work, community in living together, just community in coming together in a class, or community in working to keep the centre going, whatever it is. One of the most important ways of connecting with that consciousness is by engaging together in activity that's motivated by that that bodhicitta, and that's motivated towards that bodhicitta. And in working together in that way, on that basis, my goodness, do we get into trouble with each other. We rub up against each other, we clash with each other, because, as well as lots of other good things as well, but because we're all self-attached, when we come up against each other, we're forced to transcend ourselves. And that's the most powerful practice there is. It's very easy to sit on a cushion, I've done it, and love all sentient beings. You can do the metta bhavana and be absolutely in tune with every other living being. When you open your eyes, there's that dreadful person wearing the most awful colours and who's picking their nose or something like that. And it's gone, just in a flash. It's very easy in a sort of abstract situation. Not that that's not important, of course, but it's when it comes to when the rubber hits the road. Is that a good analogy? No, not particularly. But when you come up against another person, that's when you really notice where that self-clinging is. So it's another important thing to know about our particular community, is that we value community, we value human relationships, intense human relationships, and especially human relationships which are to do with working, practicing together, being together, trying to do things together. We value that very highly because we share the same inspiration from the bodhicitta, and we get in its way. And then we have to, through our interaction with each other, get out of the way. Of course, often it's a great deal of pleasure and fun and joy, because you do transcend together. And when you really work effectively, I've experienced this very often in even a meeting where everybody's so much in tune that it doesn't matter who makes the suggestion, it doesn't matter who's got the good idea, you almost don't notice, it just arises amongst you. It's not something only happens with us, of course, but it's that sort of experience that's intensely joyful, and that is one of our most powerful practices, this working together, living together, being together, forming deep friendships together, working together in teams. We do this because of its intrinsic joy and its intrinsic merit, but also because it's the basis for the arising of bodhicitta. So I want to move on now. I've spent half my time describing what I said yesterday, but I've come at it in slightly different terms, and actually feel a little bit clearer myself in talking about it again. I always find recapitulation good for me. But I want to move on to ways in which we can work to develop this consciousness. More ways in which we can develop this consciousness. One of the most fundamental of Buddhist ways of developing this consciousness is by connecting with it, by bringing it to mind, by connecting with it imaginatively, connecting with it even ritually, by bringing our consciousness into relationship with us, with it. You know, the most simple thing we do is to bow to the Buddha, to light candles and incense. And when you're doing that, if you have any understanding of what the Buddha is, and actually you don't even need that sometimes, it brings you in relationship to the consciousness that this image is intended to embody in plaster and whatever else, whatever the ligature underneath it is. It's intended to communicate to us, and inevitably imperfectly, it's inevitably imperfect. It's intended to communicate to us that consciousness. And if we engage with the practice of bowing in that spirit, we do get some sense of the Buddha there. I work for 6 months in India, where people have a much fresher attitude to imagination. In many ways, you know, they have their own disadvantages. But people in India find it much easier to sort of worship and to revere and to look up, to a fault, of course, sometimes. But you see people sometimes bowing, and I find it really humbling. When they bow, they clearly feel that they are really bowing to the Buddha. You can see that sometimes the Buddha sort of shining in their faces. So when I say the Buddha, what I mean is this consciousness, this bodhicitta. They're connecting with that consciousness. And we, in our own way, may do the same. We, of course, study the Buddha's words, but we need to study those words always with a sense that those words are never the full story. The words are merely an attempt to get across to us the one who said them, the consciousness from which they came, often through the imperfect medium of translation and often even not very good translation or slightly dry translation, and across the huge gap of 2,500 years of history, huge gap of culture, we can still, through those words, or through the teachings that express the Buddha's teaching, we can get to that consciousness. So we need to try to have that sort of imaginative approach, even to the teachings. I mentioned yesterday reading a novel, where you, when you read the novel, you allow yourself to enter into the characters and allow the characters to come to life for you. And the more you do that, the more effective the novel is. And, you know, writing fails when the characters just have no dimension to them. It's just, you know, this happens and that happens. But when a really good writer, novelist, short story writer, can in a few words bring a character to life so that you know them and you feel in contact with them. So we try to do, if you like, the same sort of job in a different way, on a bigger scale, a vaster scale, with the Buddha. We're trying through the words that describe his life, that describe his teaching, that express what we know is near to, probably something like what he said. We're trying to get at the consciousness behind them and trying to let that affect us, because it has a sort of direct effect on us. We have practices that we introduce people to when they've got a lot more experience and when they're much more committed, where you systematically meditate on figures, imaginative figures, whether visual or felt, if you like, that embody aspects of the Buddha's bodhicitta, of his enlightened mind. And you systematically build those up in front of you, and you come into a sort of connection with them. In many of the practices, you actually bring the figure into yourself, so that the you're not seeing the consciousness as something external to you. First of all, you are, because it is external to us, damn it. It is external to us. But we, in the end, we're trying to realise it within ourselves. It won't be exactly our consciousness, because our, you know, is too self-referential. It will be experienced by us, as operative within us, as leading us, moving us. We'll find that we do things which are not based on self, from a basis that, it seems initially to be almost other. It's not other, it's just from the point of view of self, it's other. So we try to bring that into ourselves in these sort of practices. You may have heard them referred to as sadhana, which literally just means devotional practice, or visualization practice. We slowly introduce those as people get more deeply involved, so that there are ways in which you can connect with bodhicitta. You're not trying to connect with a god or a magical figure or anything like that, although it has that sort of magical dimension to it. It's a deep archetype of the mind. But through that, you're connecting with this living bodhicitta, this living mind first discovered by the Buddha, that you're trying to, as it were, bring into yourself. Here, in, out, doesn't really make sense, but we have to use some sort of metaphorical language. So that's one of our most important practices, and all our devotional exercises, like the puja and so forth, are directed to that, to trying to bring us into a relationship to that consciousness, so that we experience it quite vividly, quite directly, as something that we're in relation to. Initially, as something we're in relation to as separate from us, because from the point of view of my self-clinging, it is separate from me. And that's how you experience it. Sometimes you experience yourself just sort of lifted up and acting in ways that you could not have premeditated, that you don't exactly feel were yours. You don't really quite know where they came from. I've experienced this a few times in situations, particularly of critical situations. You just find you know what to do. You don't know why. You don't know how. You don't even feel that you decided to do it. You just act. Of course, a metaphor that's more familiar to us is of artistic or aesthetic creation, where, you know, famously the poet says, "I didn't write it. It wrote itself, as it were, through me." Or I'm talking to a friend who's an artist, and he's saying that most of his effort in painting, he's a painter, that is, most of his effort in painting is to stop trying to think what he's doing and to let the painting paint itself. Of course, he's done a lot of sweating at art school and all that to get to that point that there's something worthwhile happens. But in the end, the true artist doesn't create. He or she allows the creation to take place through them. And that's a metaphor or an analogy on a level. It may be actually quite a lofty level in some cases. Sometimes I think the best of artists touch on this more transcendental level. You know, there's something more deeply interfused that Wordsworth famously writes of. He's clearly got intimations of immortality. He's got some sense of that. What level, it's not for me to say. I don't agree with all this classificatory stuff, who's got it and who hasn't. I think that's ego asserting itself again. Yes, it gives us an analogy that's familiar to us. But when bodhicitta is really alive in us, it's sort of ours, but not ours. We don't think of it as "I did this." And if you do think "I did this," it's not bodhicitta. If you feel pride in what you do in an egoistic sense, you can please feel delighted at what you've done. You can feel delighted that you've contributed and that you've played your part and so forth. That's different from this egoic appropriation of what you do. So bodhicitta implies that you just let go and you something operates through you that is not something other than you, but it's not you either. See what I mean? We're at the edge of possibilities of language. So we try to connect with that through a lot of our more devotional practices, and if you get more involved, you'll start to do that through meditation practices, where you consciously try to evoke a figure that embodies, that carries that spirit. To begin with, it's just your imagination connecting with it, just your imagination. It's, my goodness, even a little bit of imagination takes us a long way. But from that, you try to allow that spirit itself to arise, and then you take it into you symbolically, which means eventually, really, because actually symbols are reality. That's another story, another ramble. But yes, that's a very, very important basis, I think, for everything else I'm going to be talking about when I actually get round to it. Very, very important basis. I think without that connection with the living spirit of bodhicitta through imaginative connection, and even if you can bear it through ritual connection, if you can overcome your Catholic conditioning or your Protestant conditioning or your Hindu conditioning or whatever it is, if you can allow yourself to enter into that that imaginative mode of feeling that the Buddha is in front of you in one way or another. It's a very powerful way of connecting with bodhicitta. But the big problem is me. And when I say me, I mean you. The big problem is this habit, this deeply ingrained habit, which is, again, taking an evolutionary point of view, is actually quite a good thing, because it's sort of what gives us the power to escape the mere tyranny of the present. Animal lives in the tyranny of the present, unable to rise imaginatively beyond it. But the identification of I is a tremendous evolutionary advance to take that mode of seeing things, which is not a traditional Buddhist one. So it's a good thing, it's a good thing. Don't let's go back to animality, which is ego-less, but it's pre-ego rather than post-ego, if you see what I mean. So the problem is that even when we're trying to connect with bodhicitta, I gets in the way, this deeply ingrained habit, which is far more deeply ingrained than we realise. Mostly when people think they've got rid of ego, they mean it's very superficial, mostly psychological factors. It's much more thoroughly ingrained. It's actually in the very act of looking. When you open your eyes, the world naturally falls into I and not I. It takes a lot of work to get beyond that. It constantly gets in the way of bodhicitta. Even though we've got a sense of bodhicitta, even though we're reaching up to it and longing indeed to connect with it, I gets in the way. Because one of the features of this self-attachment is that it's self-validating. The self is a protective mechanism, and it tells a story that maintains itself, if you see what I mean. It's another cue for a song, but I won't sing it today. If we want to let that bodhicitta that we're reaching up to imaginatively really be effective in us and in the world and in our work, we have to work on that self-attachment. And as I said earlier, we don't pretend here, even though we're Buddhists and we're devoted to the bodhicitta and we go for refuge to the Buddha, we don't pretend that we are completely animated by the bodhicitta. We're also animated by self-clinging. And there's a sort of battle going on. And sometimes even our good efforts are vitiated by our self-clinging. If you hang around long enough, which probably is just about a couple of minutes, you'll notice that. But we're working on it. We're working on it, honest. So the question is, how do we work on that self-clinging, that very strong, very deep, very deeply ingrained habit of I, everything circling back to me? As I said yesterday, when I'm speaking, a little bit of my mind at least, is reflecting on how you're receiving me and whether you think I'm great or not. And, something similar, please don't be insulted. Well, if you've gone beyond ego, you won't be. Something similar is going on with you. It's just habitual. It's just natural. It's okay. It's normal. Let's just laugh about it. It's not something dreadful and, satanic or something like that, although Satan comes from it, if you like. It's just normal. So how do we get to grips with it? Well, the traditions connected with bodhicitta are really rather awkward. So prepare yourselves for some very awkward news. What those traditions say is that the best way to deal with it is to take advantage of difficulties. The first and most basic advice in developing bodhicitta is not go away and meditate on a mountain and soak yourself in bliss and so forth. Well, that's a good thing to do. But the main thing is to face up to difficulties and make them into the path. That's the way the what's called the mind training tradition, which is very, very fundamental in Mahayana Buddhism, and it's really, actually you can trace it back to the Buddha. It's make difficulties into the path. So whatever difficulty comes, make it into the path. Let's start trivial. Your computer crashes. Make that into the path. The bus has gone, and there are 10 more are coming in about half an hour. Make that into the path. You can't find your glasses. Make that into the path. Of course, that's just the trivial level of it, although that's often where we live. Getting sacked, some difficulty at work. Of course, the big one, death, whether it's, coming towards you, which it is, or whether it's the death of someone close. Make it into the path. That's what the teaching is. It's very much exemplified in these traditions that came from the Mahayana that were developed in India and Indonesia, actually, interestingly, was a major source for them. We've been kept alive principally in Tibet and China. These traditions of using your direct experience of difficulty, let's put no finer point upon it. You all know what I mean by difficulty, and probably every one of you can think of quite a long list, even today, of difficulties that you've encountered. Make them into the path. This tradition, although it's most clearly spoken about in the Indo-Tibetan tradition, which comes to us now mainly from Tibet, it does go back to India, we know that, from the great monastic universities of India, in Bihar and Bengal and Andhra Pradesh. These traditions go back there, but they were kept alive in the deep freeze of Tibet. And they've come to us mainly that way. They go back to the Buddha himself. I think you could even say in the extraordinary story, the mythic story of the Buddha's enlightenment, I think probably everybody will know this story. It's so familiar. It's a mythic story, a legendary story, that the Buddha was sitting under the Bodhi tree, determined not to move until he'd gained enlightenment, and Mara, the evil one, comes. You know the story. Mara, of course, being the embodiment of everything about clinging that keeps us here. Mara is the embodiment of that clinging within us. So Mara appears to the Buddha and tries to get him off the seat in various ways. He tries, clever arguments and so forth. But eventually he attacks. He gets his sons to attack with an army in the description. You often see pictures of the Buddha sitting under the tree with demons sort of around him firing arrows and throwing mountains and all sorts of things like that. And what you'll see in the pictures that the weapons are coming at the Buddha, and then there's a sort of aura of flowers. Because what's said to happen is that the Buddha transforms those weapons into flowers. That's what this practice is about. It's transforming the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, the difficulties that we have, into the flowers of compassion. That's what this mind training is about. But taking the difficult situations of life and turning them around. Turning them around so that they allow you to see and separate yourself from, detach yourself from that ego clinging, and then to enter into a compassionate relationship with others around, and particularly compassionate relationship with those who are causing the difficulties, because as we all know, when we talk about difficulties, we're talking about everybody else. It's other people who are the difficulty in the end. So the tradition of mind training, in my own reading, goes right back to the Buddha, and that mythic image of the Buddha transforming the arrows of Mara into the flowers of compassion, that's my own phrase, I think is the exemplification of what this bodhicitta practice is about. It's about taking all the arrows that are shot at us by just life itself, but especially by other people, because you know, you can curse an earthquake, but you can't curse it for long, as it were. But my goodness, you can carry resentment towards somebody who stole your pen for months and years. And worse, of course, particularly somebody who steals your girl or boyfriend or whatever it may be. We can carry resentments forever. We allow the arrows to go into us, and we turn them into poison, which we project outwards. So and that's a fundamental survival mechanism. Its roots are simply in flight and fight, isn't it? It's just in survival. Anything that threatens you, fight it or get out of its way. So you're really working deeply to turn around the whole nature of your response to the world around you, and to take everything difficult as an opportunity. This is the fundamental point. I'm going to go into this much more deeply. I intended to go into it much more deeply today, but I'll go more tomorrow. But I'll outline it today, because my recapitulation tomorrow will probably take up most of the time. But we try to, first of all, see whatever difficulties come as opportunities. Not opportunities in the sense of I'm going to fight and get through it. It's not like that. You know, that can be a good tactic, of course, in certain circumstances. It's not to do with worldly success and failure. Well, you know, that's another department. We have to try to take that on in the spirit of this, if you see what I mean. It's to do with trying to transform your mind by using the enormous opportunity that life offers you by creating difficulties, hundreds and hundreds of difficulties, thousands and thousands of difficulties, actual pain, you know, physical pain of illness and, you know, damage and so forth. I've been very fortunate myself to avoid that, but, you know, a few of my friends are undergoing a lot of physical pain, and I really admire them when they, and as they often seem to be, are able to take that in a positive way. And I don't just mean in a positive way in sort of, you know, mustn't grumble, got to keep cheerful. It's not a bad attitude. It's better than grumbling and not staying cheerful. But I mean in looking really deeply into it and, well, recognising truths, deep truths that go with it. Just to start at a more superficial level, if you like. You know, the first of all, if you're suffering physical pain because of illness, well, this is what happens. This is what bodies do. If you've got a body, you're going to experience illness and pain. It's just a fact. And so the first thing you can do with that difficulty is recognise the facts of life. Just recognise that as human beings, we are subject to old age, sickness and death. It's a basic reflection in Buddhism. Just recognising that we're subject to old age, sickness and death. So as a result of taking that on the chin, just accepting very fully and directly the physical pain that you experience because of illness or whatever, as a reflection of reality, well, you then must find your peace with reality, if you see what I mean. You must find a way of embracing reality, not just grinning and bearing it, and hoping that it'll go away, or just accepting, oh, well, that's it. But finding a way of turning that into flowers. I'm beginning to get a little beyond youth, and, you know, as the ages advance, I'm very fortunate. I've not suffered much ill health, but I definitely notice a slowing down. I get more tired. I lose energy more quickly, and begin to get those horrible little aches and pains. And it's very easy to feel this shouldn't be happening. Shouldn't be happening. But of course it's going to happen. Whatever is born decays and goes, disappears. Whatever comes into existence rises, falls, and goes. It's a fact. So you've got to try to come to terms with life, accepting that. And of course, I don't mean in a merely nihilistic sense, because that's the great danger with often the way in which Buddhism is communicated. It's not just a matter of saying, oh, well, you know, there we are, old age, sickness and death, ho-hum, we'll get as much pleasure as we can and can I have another glass. It's not just a question of enduring, staying calm until it's gone, till the lights go out. It's a question of trying to find a creative response to that difficulty, which is why it's important to do this sort of reflection against the background of some connection with bodhicitta. Do you see what I mean? If you don't have that connection with bodhicitta, with a living sense of bodhicitta, the idea of coming to terms with old age, sickness and death really just means a stoical endurance at best, a sort of superficial cheerfulness until, as I say, the lights go out. So you need to take the facts of life in the context of the larger picture of bodhicitta, and as a real sense of confidence in that, dare one say it, faith in that, a sense that this can be achieved, it will be achieved if you make the right effort. So this is, you know, level number one, if you like, just taking the aches and pains that ordinary life gives you and learning the lesson. The most basic lesson of all, which is that this is life. I remember a wonderful moment. I spent some time in Spain, in the mountains in Valencia, working with others to build a Buddhist center. And we had some really nice neighbors, the Valencianos, not speaking Spanish, but speaking a Catalan, a related language. And there's an old man, tremendous dignity, and his son died. It's a terrible thing for a parent, particularly an older parent, to see their children die against nature. And I went to see him to condole. And he just said, when I expressed my condolence, la vida es así, life is like that, this is life. And he said it with not sort of resignation, something like that, but with a kind of positive acceptance, which I found really inspiring. So it's a question of seeing this is what life is like. And if you cling to this life, you're going to suffer. You're going to get hurt because it's inevitable. So there has to be something bigger. There has to be something greater that you are connected with and that you live for and that your life is animated by and moving towards, that can make life meaningful despite these inevitable facts of old age, sickness and death. So that's the first level of turning difficulties into the path. And I think it's probably enough for today. I don't think it's necessary to push, you know, into bigger material too quickly. What we're obviously going to start coming into is the more difficult stuff. In a way, old age, sickness and death are difficult, of course. They're very, very difficult. But they're more easy to see. What's most difficult comes about in our interactions with humans. Our interaction with humans, whether it one-to-one or in human culture, human institutions, and so forth. That's when it gets most difficult. That's when the constructed ego identity most struggles to come to terms with difficulty. So I'd like to give you some homework, brothers and sisters. You're going to have it anyway. You'll get that homework is coming to you whether you like it or not. But I'm going to ask you to do it, not just to fudge it and say the cat ate it. But, you know, as the day goes on, the night and then the day goes on, things are going to happen to you. I promise you. I hope that you have a very smooth time over the next 24 hours, 23 hours. But I'm sorry to say I'm wise enough at my rich years to know that it won't. Something somewhere will go wrong. And I'm pretty sure that in every case it'll be somebody else. Somebody else's fault. And so I'm going to ask you to see what you do. You know, you've heard me speak. I hope you've got at least a little bit of something from what I've said. How are you going to turn those arrows, that particular arrow, that particular Mara, that particular demon, how are you going to turn their arrows into flowers of compassion so that you can even see them as lovable? How are you going to do that? Do you manage? I'm not going to ask you to account for yourselves. I probably should, but I'm going to leave it to your own consciences. Please just sort of see if you can see what I mean as the days go by, and see as the day goes by, and see what happens when difficulty comes, difficulty particularly generated by something else. If it's too difficult, please don't try, you know, because you may be in the middle of, you know, a severe crisis of some kind. So please don't sort of add burden to burden. But if you're feeling relatively confident and strong and feel able to do this, well, then just see what happens when some difficulty arises, particularly something caused by somebody else. It may be just somebody cutting you up in a queue or whatever, some nasty comment that somebody makes, a cold voice at work, or, you know, your wife or husband may not always act in an entirely sympathetic and loving way. It happens. Your children or whatever. See how you respond. See if you can make that arrow into a flower. Tomorrow I'll give you a theoretical outline of how one might do that by looking at two aspects of this, what I call reaction practice, which is learning to see the arrow and what that does to you, and learning from what the arrow does inside you. And response practice is, which is turning that arrow into a flower. So tomorrow we'll focus more on how you work with that. But please do, if you can bear it, just sort of notice difficulties and what they do to you and how you try to work with them. And see you tomorrow. I hope that, I'm not going to say I hope you have a lot of difficulties, but I hope you do find creative ways to work with those. If you have a lot of difficulties, you have my sympathies, and I hope you can find something in what we're talking about to benefit you, to help you. Tomorrow we'll give more kind of intimate examination to this. So thank you very much. See you tomorrow.